Hello and welcome to The Urbanist, Monocle's programme all about the built environment. I'm Andrew Tuck. Today we convene the first of our 2024 debates here on The Urbanist, with our spotlight fixed on sports facilities. How can a stadium help a neighbourhood succeed? How can a major sporting event bring a positive legacy to an area? And how can design help encourage equality for both players and spectators? We're joined by three experts in the sporting field, sporting design that is, to answer these questions and more. That's ahead over the next 30 minutes here on The Urbanist. I'm going to hand over to our moderator for today's discussion, Carlotta Rebello. Take it away, Carlotta.
Thanks, Andrew. As you say, I'm joined today by three superstar guests, starting on my left with Lindsay Johnston, the co-founder of the award-winning British architectural studio BDP Pattern, who are behind a number of iconic sports venues, including two FIFA World Cup stadiums. Across from me is Kevin Owens, who is the founder of London-based practice Wu Architects and is involved with the upcoming Paris Olympic Games, among the firm's other sporting projects across the world. And to my right is Angus Campbell, a senior partner at Foster & Partners and one of the brains behind some of their most complex and prestigious projects, including London's Wembley Stadium. Well, thank you all for joining me here in the studio. I'd like to begin by asking us to make a case for the public good of stadiums. Kevin, perhaps I can start with you. What are some of the benefits that cities can receive from embracing sporting developments?
Well, I think stadia are core parts of any modern city and actually become part of the culture of a city, and really provides an outlet for both celebration, well-being, community. So it's almost like the cathedrals of our era that we're fortunate enough to deliver. And there are always the most compelling of buildings to work with within communities, because in many ways they become the anchor representing a city, even a nation. So I think they play a critical role as we look at the new fabric of cities.
Lindsay, I saw you nodding along there. I'm interested to hear your thoughts as well in this sense of community building that major sports venue and stadium can bring to our cities. What are your thoughts there on that?
Yeah, I nodded when Kevin said they're like the cathedrals of our time in a sort of increasingly secular society. It's the one place you can go with a huge crowd of people and really celebrate. And when you go into a stadium, the atmosphere is completely amazing and it always gives you a tingle. I always feel like crying when I sing Flower of Scotland, for instance, at Murrayfield. I think it's great. Obviously, hospitals, education, office buildings are very important, but a stadium is a celebration and it's also great for young people.
Now, one of the things that's interesting when we consider these designs is, of course, the side of infrastructure and how it plays into the fabric of the city. And coming to you on that point, Angus, how crucial is it for this notion of community building to then have that integration with transport, integration with a way of getting to these places that doesn't always require a car?
You raise a really interesting point about venues. I mean, as Lindsay was mentioning, venues are great places to bring people together, but you have to get to them. And therefore, a venue surrounded by a sea of car parking, which then means congestion getting to and from the event, is kind of a disaster, really. And therefore, having public transport, which is really what is required for cities to function properly, is crucial. And then the relationship of the venue to the public transport and how people get to and from the venue is kind of critical. But for me, sports venues and their position in cities is, well, football clubs grew as representing their city. So they're very community-based. And I think, you know, a big thing is they need to keep that heart. Just because a rich owner has taken them, they shouldn't lose their connection with the city. But the public transport is fundamental to the selection of where you put the stadium. Our experience on Wembley was really interesting, because if you think, Wembley Stadium was built for the kind of the Empire Games in 1923, but the whole Metropolitan line was built to expand residential out to the northwest. And the Empire Games was an event and a big park back in the 1920s. So then in effect, the venue then continued, became the National Stadium. But the city's kind of Wembley's grown around it. And since the new stadium was built, the whole precinct is now complete. We did a master plan and 15 years later, it's built, because you have a stadium and you have an arena and they both share the same public transport and access.
Kevin, in the introduction, you mentioned the work you've done around the Olympics. And one thing that's interesting with, you know, events of that magnitude, because they do take over the cities that host them, not just for when they're in town, but, you know, the years before and afterwards. Are we seeing more and more this idea of legacy plans to think about the afterlife of these spaces and how exactly these sporting venues can play a role in that future of the city?
Absolutely. I mean, legacy is critical and should be the starting point. Historically, it's not been, and we're seeing that more and more. And I think taking a view of legacy is kind of interesting because there's two sides to it for me. There's one in terms of the legacy of the built infrastructure that we leave behind, but there's also then that legacy of the memory, the fingerprint that an event leaves behind on a city as well. And I think both of those are critically important. More and more, we're seeing a lighter touch. You know, we're big proponents of this, of actually, you know, how to deliver a strong legacy, how to deliver a sustainable event is to build less and to challenge the kind of preconceived ideas of what a venue should be, often in terms of capacity, transport being a critical piece of going, don't overbuild, so that you actually create spaces which are appropriately scaled for the city. And so legacy becomes a fundamental, that's your starting point. Because if you get the legacy wrong, nobody will thank you 20 years later. And we've seen a host of examples of when it goes wrong. But also, I think thankfully, you know, there's some really great examples of when it really works. But I think there's still an awful lot of work to do as we move through. And I think it's also critically, especially with the Games and Olympics, and when we look at stadia, you know, there's often an assumption that you bring the show into town and it's almost like it arrives. It almost could be an alien form come in, landed in a city and often leaving elements which historically may have not been part of that fabric of the city. I think there's a part here that we need to play of actually making the Games fit the context that they're within. And I think that's one of the critical parts of legacy.
That touches in an important point, which is, of course, that bringing these major venues into cities needs to be done in a sustainable way. And Lindsay, perhaps I get your thoughts on this. You know, what are then some of the challenges in delivering these large-scale projects when, thankfully, climate concerns are way higher in the agenda than, let's say, 10 years ago and way more into the mainstream that the public will challenge authorities or developers if that's not taken into consideration?
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of, let's say, Olympics and FIFA World Cups now, and they're really pushing to reuse stadiums rather than build new ones. So that's obviously the first principle, is to try and use something that you've already got. If you have to build, do it sustainably. There's a good statistic when Beijing Bird's Nest Stadium was built for the Olympics in 2004. It had 40,000 tonnes of steel, and it was actually celebrated as the biggest steel structure in the world. 4 years later, London Olympics came along, it had 1/10 of the steel. So just in those 4 years, it's amazing, you know, how much culture has shifted and society has shifted. There's lots of sustainable things we do. Stadiums are very reliant on concrete. It's got large spans, but we all need to do more research into using lightweight steel, timber and concrete with a green reused aggregates in it. And also sustainability is also about the legacy. It's about what it gives back to the community. It's not just carbon footprint. It's what it gives once the World Cup or the Olympics leaves.
Is it something that is similar to both of you as well? This idea of sustainability being more in the minds of clients and of those who approach you?
It's not just sports. Every single project in our office comes in and the first conversation is what's there already, what's the extra that they want to do to it, and you look to adapt what is already there. And then when you design it, you look at the lowest carbon footprint that you possibly could for the materials you choose, and you try and passively do it to minimize it. I mean, we're working quite extensively, not so much in sports, but in the Nordics. And the Nordics, they're ahead of the game. You know, there's a reason why Greta Thunberg is kind of a child coming through there. She's very vocal just because they're pushing it. And therefore, I think we all have a duty. So particularly on stadiums, there's a lot of historic old stadiums that need upgrading because the sight lines, there can be a better spectator experience. You shouldn't just have to demolish to do it. You should work harder to adapt what's already there to try and do it with a carbon footprint and make that a key driver. It shouldn't be greenwashing. It should be a fundamental part of the design process.
Absolutely. I mean, it rings so true. I mean, for us at the moment, I mean, we're fortunate for the technical architects for Camp Nou redevelopment. And I think that's a prime example of a stadium which is globally recognised 100,000 or so seats, now going to be delivered with 105,000 seats, but repurposing. So actually, we talk about sustainability. You know, that was a fundamental starting point. You know, rather than demolish and rebuild, you know, straight away, the challenge is keep as much as we can, and then really to develop the most efficient model. So there, the example is, you know, keeping the lower two tiers and rebuilding an upper tier, but a much lighter weight upper tier, and also with a passive environment, so that you end up creating what was historically a robust concrete bowl, should we say, and then, you know, returning it as a new modern interpretation, whilst also, I think, uniquely, you know, trying to keep hold of the character, because I think that's also one of the things that we all strive for in our venues, of making them of their place. It's very easy to then create the generic. So, you know, retaining character is critical. And I think also just from a sustainability as well point, when we're looking at the games and looking at Olympics, when we're talking about stadia and events that bring tens of hundreds of thousands of people, it's a bit of an oxymoron as well when we say a sustainable games or a sustainable event. So straight away, you're up against it in terms of anything that brings hundreds of thousands of people to a city. Your challenges are preset before you even begin the design challenge.
You touched there upon a point that brings me to the role as well of temporary structures. For example, for major sporting events, we know that a lot of these are built with the purpose of then being demolished. How do you approach that then, knowing that, you know, at the end of, let's continue to use the Olympics just as an example, but of course not exclusive to that. What is then the challenge of when you know a structure is built from the very beginning with the idea that it won't become a permanent part of the city? How do you minimize the impact then?
This comes back to the legacy question. So first and foremost, as a bid stage, at the kind of at that broader master planning, you know, making sure that what's the business plan, what's the capacity, what's the number of venues that work for the nation, for the city, etc., and start with that and then bring back the event. The other part as well is then challenging the requirements of the event. Everyone will tell you that a FIFA World Cup stadium needs to be X thousand seats. Same in the Olympics. What we tend to do is we'll challenge and go, okay, you say you need 15,000 seats in this temporary venue. Can we make it 10? But can we then make that a better business case for the city, for the host nation, etc., and bring that back so that you look at it holistically. Historically, you know, very much it's been a case of you're delivering the request. And I think it's down to us as designers and architects to challenge from the outset, rather than what you want, is that what we need? And then bringing that back into the needs and requirements of the communities and the cities that inherit the facilities that you leave behind.
Just to add that I do think there is a market for demountable buildings that can pop up, as you're talking about. You know, I go to Queens every year, watch the tennis, and they pop it up and it's fantastic. Take it down, it sits back as a community court. And I think examples like kind of ABBA Voyage, where they've built an all-timber structure. When London gets bored of it, the venue and the animation can go on tour. You know, it can go on tour. And in many ways, that's a really clever model. I think when you host, we're talking about World Cups and Olympics and one-off events, one thing that drives me crazy about many venues is that they have lots of public facilities that are locked inside the venue. And when the event is not on, you might as well have put a fence around them, and it's bonkers. Our dream is always to put a kind of a venue in an inner city enclosure where the venue faces outwards and you utilize the streets around it so that it's a 24-hour destination. It's just the fact that it happens to host an event inside doesn't mean that it has to be a fortress the rest of the time.
Well, it comes to that question of how these structures can help transform an area, transform a neighbourhood, and in many cases, make it as well. So, Lindsay, coming to you first, do you have any good examples of when you think stadiums have been successful at this? And perhaps what are the benchmarks here? What makes it a stadium that is successful in delivering this positive change for the neighbourhood it sits in?
One of the first stadiums I worked on was Manchester City Stadium, and it was in the 1990s, and Manchester had won the Commonwealth Games, and they were very concerned that they had to have a really strong legacy. So they went to Manchester United and they said, after the Commonwealth Games, would you like to come to this new stadium we're building? And Manchester United said no. So then there was Man City Football Club down the road in Main Road Stadium, and they were only in the First Division. So they said yes. So over whatever it was, 10, 20 years, they paid the council back in ticket revenue. But that's been such a huge success because Man City is now one of the greatest clubs in the world. It attracted the sponsorship deals of the Etihad Stadium, and then all around it. I mean, there's so much development now. There's housing, there's the Women's Man City Football Training Centre with a women's football stadium in it, which is fantastic. So I think that's a great asset and it really worked well. And I think in the UK we actually do it well compared to, you know, Beijing gets criticised because not many people are using it now because it didn't have a strong legacy plan at the outset. Some countries run into problems because of operational costs, like Rio, because once you build these stadiums, you've got to be able to afford to keep them going.
Staying more or less on this topic, I'm curious in at what makes the ideal location for this. Because if we think that, you know, a stadium can be a catalyst for positive change, there is an argument to say, let's put it in an area that is desperate for revitalization. But if we go back to the argument that we were having earlier about how it's great to be connected to the transport network, how it's good that people can easily access it, then you would see it being more in the inner city and closer to the existing amenities. So is there a correct formula of what makes the perfect location to build a major sporting venue?
I wish there was, because you know, I'd be far richer than I am right now. No, but I think it's a really good point. And I think this really comes down to, it's a complex mix. And really, it comes down to location, city, community. So there's so many factors. I mean, we can take a look at Olympic Park in London. You don't get that kind of investment normally around a stadium to enable you to do that. You know, similarly with City of Manchester Stadium, you know, there's a Kickstarter. More often than not, we're coming to clubs or institutions that have existing facilities that they're grappling with, which they've inherited a lot of the time. And so there's a level of sensitivity that you need to bring. And I think part of that mix as well, and we picked up on it, you know, Angus picked up on it, in terms of the ability to be open. Because it's worth remembering that a lot of these stadia will run for maybe 25, 30 days per year at the capacity that they're designed for. You then have this period of over 300 days where, in essence, you know, they are these resting hulks. So it's that balance between location, scale of what you're delivering in terms of capacity, and then it's connection to community. So I don't necessarily think there's the perfect piece, but that's also the analysis that really takes the time. And, you know, you get that bit right, the successes that we see are built on that.
Well, let's stay with this topic of the community development side and the role in transforming an area. Lindsay mentioned there a few examples, but I'm curious from both of you, other examples of where you think this has really been done right, and why are those perhaps some of the examples to look out for if you are debating what to do?
I'll give you two examples. My starting position would be kind of is Wembley and my own personal experience from that, because Wembley, there's this connection with a place. You know, there was a whole debate about where should the National Stadium be. And we had to go through a whole, should it go to Birmingham? Should it go to Manchester? Should it go to... So it's the National Stadium. It's been there for 70 years and they wanted it at Wembley. So there's a place. The space was there because you had the Empire Games in 23 and really it was all light industrial, never been replaced. Then at that time, it was the first project that had got lottery funding. So we had to design a stadium that could host the Olympics. But our client was the Football Association, and it was Ken Bates, the chairman of, at the time, of Chelsea. And he was a, athletics. It's primarily a football stadium. And you have a conflict between sight lines for football and sight lines for athletics. And in the Manchester Stadium, it was very clever. You built it as an athletic stadium and dug down to build the football pitch. In Wembley, we designed the lower tier for football and the upper tier for athletics. And you could have built a platform 6 metres above the pitch and had an athletics track. But in the end, it was a whole political fun and games. In the end, they decided to build a new stadium down at kind of Stratford, and $1 billion was spent on that. But I think what was very successful at Wembley since the time when we designed it was we designed it as an integral part of a 15-year master plan. And now, if you go there, there's a dense urban community around it that is full of hotels and apartments, offices. It's a proper thriving district in an area of light industrial. So that's obviously my personal experience. The other stadium I think people should go and take a close look at is Brentford Stadium. And I was there watching Liverpool a few weeks ago, and I think they've done an absolutely incredible job there because the club was very clever. It bought some land in an ideal location. They then teamed up with a developer to build residential apartments around the stadium. And then to get planning permission, the Section 106 agreement was to build a community asset, and they built the stadium. So there you have a 17,000-seat stadium embedded in a residential quarter. And the people who bought those apartments know it's next to football. So they knew that when they bought it. And it's just a very successful creation of a proper destination space around venue, which I just think is a great model for all stadiums.
I mean, from our repertoire, remembering back, is like AFC Wimbledon. So we relocated Wimbledon from Plough Lane to their new stadia. And that was a similar model to the Brentford model of a combined effort with developer and the club, but also delivering a scalable stadium. So there ended up delivering 10,000 seats with the ability for it to extend to 20. So building out the core community facility, but then at the same time being realistic of the growth of a club, because this is also part of the challenge as well of actually establishing, because we can look at successful clubs who have been at the top of the top and then, you know, 20 years later, they're struggling with gigantic facilities that they can't fill. So striking that balance, I think, is key. One other one that I throw in just as a complete tangent, because it was somewhere I went to a few weeks ago with my son. We were in St. Gallen in Switzerland, and we went to see St. Gallen versus Winterthur in the Swiss League. And we went to St. Gallen Stadium. I'd never been, never seen it on the stadium app of going, oh, must go see this. And uniquely, it's a stadium on top of a shopping mall. And it's the first time I've walked through a shopping mall and went, popped up, and then came straight into the stadium. Quite brilliant in many ways, because these two hubs of our society, shopping, sport, literally as the sandwich on top of each other, really successful. So very simple model, very simple stadium, 20,000 seats, and actually both operated at the same time. And that's also what I found quite refreshing, because often we see a stadium come into play and the cones go out, the road closures go in, etc. So it was actually quite nice to see these two kind of activities coexisting on a Saturday afternoon.
And one doesn't impact the other negatively. You remind me there a few years ago, I went to watch a match in Zurich, and this was the Grasshopper Stadium, a very small stadium as well. And what struck me was that you almost can't see it from the street level, because you enter at the top level and the stadium is dug down. And I just had never been in a place, and of course we're talking here a smaller venue, but where the impact in the surrounding area of having this massive arena that it doesn't match what might have been the existing neighborhood. It was a really interesting experience. And earlier we talked about, you know, infrastructure and the importance of having the amenities around it. And it reminded me of the new stadium of the Los Angeles Football Club. I was in LA when we opened our office there in 2019, when the stadium was being built. And I remember the shock of some people that I spoke to, because it did not have parking. It was integrated with the transit line. And we know that in Los Angeles, parking is a must for the majority of people. Taking the metro is still an ongoing journey. But it was an example where, as we've been having this conversation, made me think about sometimes you're going to have that resistance to change and you need to wait, you know, as we were saying these all these examples, those years to actually see the results back, and the community hopefully will eventually thank you for it. So I guess I'm curious from your perspective, if, you know, you have to be quite confident that, you know, this is our vision for this area. It's going to work. We might have some resistance to start with, but, you know, it's worth putting up with it. Would you agree with this statement, Lindsay? Your thoughts?
Yeah, I was thinking about putting stadiums in inner cities. So I think if there's already a historic stadium in the inner city and you replace it, everyone's quite happy about that. However, if you decided, like right now, we were going to stick a new stadium in the centre of London, it would probably get a lot of opposition. So I think that the best model is like Manchester City or like the London Olympic Park, where you extend the city out and you build the new infrastructure, because then everyone wants to live around it and create businesses next to it. But I think if it's the opposite way around and you plant something into a city, that would cause a lot of hassle. And also, you know, the infrastructure just isn't there for it. It's really difficult to build a new, whatever, a metro into a city if it doesn't already exist.
I agree with what Lindsay is saying, is that in many ways, whatever goes next to a stadium needs to be fully aware the positives and the negatives of a stadium. And that's why I think the Brentford example is so good, because there's apartments, there's no extra space. It's just the walking space and preamble to and from the apartments. But the people who live in those apartments know every single person was out on their balcony watching the football and loving being in that event. To me, you should build right up to the stadium. There should not be a sea of car park. The concourse should be as tight as it possibly could be. And they should be streets between them without vehicles. You've got to get the vehicles away, you've got to get the pedestrians and get that. But that said, a space that's actually built knowing what's happened, you can't just impose it on an existing building fabric that isn't suitable. I was going to say, just following on from Kevin's example, that I think there's so many lessons in history. And I remember going to Lucca in Italy, and you can find the arena in there. You follow the street pattern, and the arena is a carved out arena with the houses built right up to it as an oval right in the middle of the city. And you meander your way through, and it's like, oh my God, this is perfect. You know, and they built it 2,000 years ago. I think the model has always been there, but you have to be able to ensure that you can transport and get there on public transport. Otherwise, the cars get in the way.
I don't want to wrap up our roundtable without touching on one important thing. We've been talking here about inclusivity in terms of transport and accessibility, but there's a growing conversation about the users of these places. Traditionally, of course, has been a male audience, male players. We've been thankfully seeing that change over the last couple of years with more and more interest in women's sports and purpose-built stadiums for the women's team as well. And we often know that if you build something to be inclusive for women, you're making it inclusive for everyone. Are you seeing that conversation pepper through your work and your conversations with clients to, you know, design spaces that are more inclusive in this way, that, you know, big sporting venues can be an intimidating place for women, and the design can play a big role here to making sure these are welcoming spaces? Kevin?
So the good news answer is yes, we are. Is it being materialized, you know, and realized at the moment? It's a challenge. Mm-hmm. But we are definitely seeing on both sides as well, from an athlete, an understanding of athlete requirements. So actually on the Wembley model, we've been very fortunate to be the in-house architects with the FA for the last 7 years. And one of the things that we were brought in to look at, for instance, is the changing rooms. And it's just an interesting one, as an understanding has shifted in terms of what a player needs from a male, from a football, but also then to the female. So we were lucky enough there at Wembley to pick up the great design, actually then to tweak that and bring that back into the kind of, because all of a sudden, hang on a minute, the women's team are playing here. And we need equality, but also equality across both home and away, which is always another piece. So we are seeing that come through. But also, I think the more important thing that we're seeing on all our work is actually from the user. So that we're being asked now, you know, to consider facilities that are truly inclusive and have the ability to flex. Because historically as well, we can look at our audience, and historically a football audience would be predominantly male. And we'd be sitting there going, you know, and we've all witnessed the horror show of a half-time moment. And so I'm not going into too much detail. So really it's taking a focus of the public-facing side of things, because also the benchmark for our stadia are no longer stadia. The benchmark for stadia are the facilities that we come into touch with every day. So that comes into the shopping, that comes into our hotels, our retail, our other buildings. And so historically you could, don't worry, it's a stadium. There's an expectation of it may be a bit poor, but you know the rest of it would be great. Not anymore. So we're seeing that come more and more, because actually that's also for venue owners a very critical point, because that's where also we're bringing extra value.
Lindsay, I'm curious if in a weird way there's an advantage to, you know, being a woman in this field, working in these major sporting venues, which, as we were discussing, traditionally have been male-centric. Even if your clients hadn't been asking you to equate this, it's just in your instinct to think, if this is a place that's welcoming for me. So I wonder how that has influenced your work over the last few years, and if it's perhaps quite nice to see the industry matching it now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whenever I go to a match in an old stadium, I get really, really frustrated because you have to do the half-hour queue for the toilet. And I mean, even over the last 20 years, there's nothing that we would design that doesn't have great toilets for women, that doesn't have breastfeeding rooms, changing facilities for disabled people, sensory rooms for people with autism, lots of baby changing facilities, places for kids. So those days are, I hope, are days of the past. And yeah, it's definitely become a lot more inclusive. Another thing about the training ground at Man City is they've got a small stadium for the women. And hopefully in years to come, the women will be able to sell out crowds as large as the men's. But that's also really important, is to fill your stadium. So if you've got a little stadium next door that the women's matches can get held in, you know, it's a great atmosphere rather than have 5,000 fans in a stadium for 60,000 or whatever it might be.
Well, big ambitions for all aspects of the industry, but we are certainly in safe hands to fulfill those goals with today's panel. Lindsay, Kevin and Angus, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure speaking to you today here on The Urbanist.
Thanks, Colotta, for this week's episode of The Urbanist. For more from the world of urbanism, subscribe to the podcast so you get new episodes every week. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and by David Stevens, who also edits this show. I'm Andrew Tuck. Goodbye, and thank you for listening, City Lovers.